Actually, I have to tell you a secret. I'm right now, while we are producing this episode, I'm having on my German house shoe, you know?
The Icebot is the podcast about polar science and the people.
We talked to scientists who went on board Polarstern, the German research icebreaker, for the biggest research expedition in the Arctic. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the fifth full episode of The Icebot, the podcast of the Year of Polar Prediction. We are again here at our home studios. My name is Kirstin Werner, and over there is Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kirstin.
How's it going?
It's good. I'm happy with how we managed to find this format, and it's still going, even though we cannot go to the studio.
Yeah. But still, we have some support by Radio Weser TV.
Yes.
They usually final editing our episodes, and they are supporting us. Before we actually go into the episode and the interview with Anja Sommerfeld, so you can be excited to hear her in a moment, we wanted to give a brief update on where's Polarstern now, what's going on. Today is the 14th of July already. Mm-hmm. We're deep into summer.
We had a small summer yesterday and the day before, but it was November the past week. So
Right. Yeah. So, but Polarstern, I mean, it's there now on their leg four. They arrived back at the central ice floe around the 18th of June, mm-hmm. after the new team was picked up by Polarstern, but brought to the ice edge by the German vessels Maria S. Merian and Sonne.
Yeah, the exchange happened on a fjord in Svalbard, or close to Svalbard.
And yeah, they had about 8 days of travel from the sea ice edge to the ice floe, mm-hmm. the fortress. And it's the same ice floe they went to as before. If you listen to Markus Rex being on this German podcast, Arctic Drift Audio Log, he explains why he's so happy about this ice floe, because in the surrounding ice floes, there's lots of instability. So there are big melt ponds these days, while on the ice floe the Mosaic team is working on, there are also melt ponds, but there's also a lot of ridges. So actually the melted water is going into the ponds and they can still work through the ponds and put their instruments there. So in this Arctic Drift podcast, Markus Rex, so he is back now as a chief scientist on board Polarstern, is also giving insights about what happened actually during the COVID situation and how, you know, they were struggling a while, what to do, how to exchange the teams, could the expedition continue and things like that. And he said a very nice sentence I noted down before. Almost every expedition, cruises and things like that had to stop or to be canceled, but Mosaic continues.
We are curious to see the developments.
They did a lot of reinstallations during the last couple of weeks. They rebuilt the Miss Piggy place, the Balloon Town. And you will hear about Balloon Town and Miss Piggy a bit later from Anja, actually. They put the Met Tower out again. So Met Tower is a huge tower, 10 meters high. I looked it up. It has 19 sensors to measure all kinds of atmospheric stuff. So really impressive. And they needed lots of manpower, I think, to put this tower back again. I was also looking up the weather today at Polarstern. If you don't know that, there is a nice app you can put on your smartphone. It's called yr.no, year.no. I don't know what it means, something Norwegian, because it's run by Met Norway, by our nice colleagues from Met Norway.
And we heard it was the secret for Thomas's success in our first Twitter challenge for the first targeted observing period.
And so it means that this app actually does a quite good forecast, at least for the northern regions. So today, 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. It says cloudy throughout the day at Polarstern's location, 0 degrees centigrade, feels like -4 degrees mm-hmm. centigrade. And then it also says there is a light breeze from the southwest. So not too bad. Usually they have lots of foggy days in the Arctic, and this is interesting also for you guys outside listening to that. So why is there foggy days in the Arctic whenever there's sea ice? Because the warm air from the south, from our summer south here in Europe, hits the cold surface that is influenced by the sea ice on the bottom. And that makes that the moist air condenses, and then you have the fog. And that influences the helicopter operations. They can get delayed and stuff like that. But luckily, when the new team arrived at Polarstern, they had quite a lot of sunny days. So they had 17 days already on helicopter flight days. So that's actually not too bad. And I also wanted to let you know that there is the first paper, as far as I know, the first paper on MOSAIC is out and published now. It was published in the Cryosphere. The paper was written by Thomas Krumpen, a colleague from the Alfred Wegener Institute. Thomas Krumpen and colleagues, and he wrote this paper on actually where this MOSAIC ice flow originated from. Lots of sea ice is actually built not just in the middle of the Arctic Ocean, but on the Siberian shelves. Mm-hmm. And with this MOSAIC ice flow, they found in ice cores what we, like normal humans, would call dirt. You know, like sandy stuff and so. And actually, but the scientists, like me also, when I worked in the Arctic, we called that the ice rafted debris.
Okay.
So you would find these dirty layers in the sea ice core. Mm-hmm. And people wondered where this comes from, because usually you would think there's only water in the Arctic Ocean. Yeah. And so Thomas Krumpen and many other scientists speculated that the sea ice actually builds on the Siberian shelves, which are really shallow shelves. And then the ice moves a lot on the shelf. So it would take up the sand and all the stuff. And so they found that this MOSAIC ice flow has these dirty ice layers, so to say.
Yeah.
They had some fancy way to track back where this ice was formed. And they found that ice flow formed in a Polynya event. Polynya is actually an open water event within the Arctic ice, north of the New Siberian Islands, in December 2018.
Okay.
But as I understood, there are also older parts of ice included now to that ice flow. So I think they just merged together. So it's called the MOSAIC Ice Flow Sediment-Laden Survivor from the Siberian Shelf.
Yeah, so go check it out.
And now we have to tell you something. So Anya's episode, the one you will hear in a moment, that was the first one we did from our homes.
True.
Due to the pandemic, we had to
find new arrangements for recording this podcast, because we really didn't want to stop. We wanted to bring new episodes still. So in the end, we found new arrangement. So we have now very fancy microphones, and we are using this very nice tool, which is Squadcast. So we can record everything online. But this was a work in progress, let's say.
This took us a while. And what actually happened when we recorded with Anya,
it was on the 24th of April. When we started the recording, I was already using the fancy microphone. Unfortunately,
I didn't.
Yes, yours arrived exactly in the middle of our interview, actually.
Right.
So we witnessed live the unboxing of Kirsten's new, very brand new microphone. Meant, however, that for some technical issues that are still a mystery to us, the previous microphone did not record Kirsten's voice almost at all. It was impossible, basically, to edit the first hour of our interview, simply because one person was missing. So it was me and Anya making comments randomly, or Anya answering questions that we couldn't hear anymore. So
yeah, we tried to recover this part, but there was no way.
So in the end, we had to let it go.
And I put the blue blankets around me that day and I tried to set up everything perfectly. But if the microphone doesn't work, it's not
there's no blanket that can help you and come to your rescue. That's true.
Yeah. But luckily, I changed microphones just after this 1 hour. So you might notice some sentences there we don't really explain that has to do because we talked about that maybe before in that first hour, but we didn't want to cut this. So yeah.
What you are going to hear at the beginning is actually was the middle of a conversation about a game that Anya and her fellow companions on Polashan were playing, which was the murderer game. So it was a group of people involved in this game in which two were assigned as the murderers. So these murderers had the goal, so to say, to kill as many of the other players by a certain amount of time or in general in order to survive and win the game. And Anya was actually one of the murderers. So she had to find her sneaky ways, to come to a person and very gently and friendly kill that person. Of course, not in a violent way, but just by saying so. We also want to advertise a podcast, a relatively new podcast that is produced by Sam Cornish from the University of Oxford. He was one of the students at the Mosaic School at the beginning of the whole Mosaic expedition in September and October. Mm-hmm. And for his outreach project, because now each student is a Mosaic ambassador, he has decided to develop this podcast, which is called the Mosaic Mixdown, MIDI podcasts from the Arctic. So far, Sam produced 4 episodes. Each of them is like from 2.5 to 7 minutes long episodes. And mm-hmm. they just dive into very specific questions. So, for example, how is Mosaic being constructed? What does Mosaic stand for? And he just interviews other people in the podcast, and he explains very simple concepts in a very brief amount of time.
It's like an audio collage.
So check it out. I found it on Spotify. I think you can find it also on Apple Podcasts and other platforms.
But before we actually leave you now to the murderer game and other stuff, we need to explain briefly who actually Anya is. So Anya, actually, most of you know her name. She is the project manager of Mosaic, and she will talk about that in that episode. She studied metrology in Berlin at the Freie Universität. And then she did her PhD at the University of Potsdam and the Alfred Wegener Institute in Potsdam about some fancy modeling stuff we also talk about in the episode. After that, she moved right into the project management of Mosaic.
It's time for Anya's interview now. So we hope you enjoy it.
Yeah. And Sarah, one more thing. I'm wearing my German indoor shoes again.
I have the summer version now. So I have my flip flops.
Good. We were talking about the murderer game, and we found out that Anya was one of the murderers, and she was really feeling bad about it because she is not a good liar. So Anya, did you always, when you killed someone by just saying you're dead now, Did you always apologize afterwards?
Yes. Yeah, and people, when I tell to people, oh, you are dead now, they will be like, what? Huh? What? And they don't really, they didn't
expect you to be
at all. They were so surprised that I am the murderer. Yeah, but that was very much fun. And I think I had a good strategy to be the murderer because I don't plan to kill anybody. I just, when I see somebody spontaneously in the hallways or in the staircase, I just say, okay, you are dead now.
It just happens to you.
Yes,
you're
exactly.
Killing someone.
Best way also, I mean, you know, quick and dirty, you don't even suffer.
And I was always making sure that I was really going somewhere. For example, on my way, going to the gym or going out on the ice, I just kill somebody so that I have an alibi. So that I could say, oh no, I could not be the murderer because I was on the ice or I was in the gym. And that helped a lot.
Well thought through strategy, I would say.
It took me one day to start killing, actually. Yeah. So because I really, and I, of course, I had to learn who I'm allowed to kill because not everybody is participating in the game. So I really had to go through the list again and look who is playing and who not.
That was what I wanted to ask. So you check marked everyone you killed on your paper. See, that's a real scientist, you know, walking around with papers.
Yeah,
who to kill.
Actually, I did an Excel sheet writing down when I killed someone and where.
Well, I guess the other murderer was uncovered so early because he didn't have this Excel sheet, right?
No, that was actually because another guy just asked him. So another participant in the game, who was one of the victims, asked, "Are you the other murderer?" And then the actual murderer said, "Yes, I am." And then the other guy said, "Okay, then you are dead now." So it was kind of a trick. And
does the murderer has to answer if he's asked if he's the murderer?
He can answer. But
okay.
He then really thought that the other one, the guy asking him is the other murderer because we don't know who are the murderers.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay. I see. Hmm.
And the funny thing, there was a second round of playing murderer. And then my roommate was a murderer, so we were the roommates. Both of us were murderers.
It's a sinful room.
Yeah. So, Anya, just going back briefly to the Bear Watch, you brought a song, another song, by Rammstein.
Yes.
Sonne.
Exactly. That was, I chose this song because when I did Bear Watch or Bridge Watch in the morning, I was always on the bridge with Officer Lutz Peiner, and he always had music on. And very often it was something from Fabio's Life of Amelie. I don't know if that's the correct translation, but this French movie. And it was Rammstein with Sonne. So, and I chose for this song.
Interesting pair also as a like types of music.
Yeah. He had all kind of music, but Rammstein I like most.
Cool. Yeah. And it was especially good to listen to that song when it was totally dark.
Darkness. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Then we listen to Sonne by Rammstein.
Okay, Anya, I wanted to know a little bit more how you, because we talked about you being a scientist, doing your PhD in atmospheric science. I wanted to know two things, actually, how you got into the role of a project manager of Mosaic. So this is one. And then also, what was your role on board, which I think is also really interesting because as the project manager of Mosaic, you're probably the person who knows, maybe Markus Rex also, but maybe after Markus Rex, you are the person who knows best about Mosaic.
Yeah.
And then having you on the ship, I think this is interesting. But then also having you doing atmospheric research, so to say. But maybe first we start with the project management. So you did your PhD and then you also got some kind of postdoc position, with Klaus Detloff, I think, at AWI Potsdam. And then, I mean, how did it happen that you became the project manager at Mosaic?
Klaus was and at this time, Klaus was still the head of Mosaic because he was the section leader of the atmospheric section. And there was no further money for employing me as a scientist and as a postdoc. But he had the position that he can have a project manager for Mosaic. So he was a coordinator at this time. And he just asked me, and it fits perfectly from the timing. So because my postdoc finished, and then I could, and then the management position starts. So there was only 1 month in between. And that was perfect. He just asked me, and I said, yes, why not? It sounds interesting. It's a great project. And and then I decided to take this position so that I can do something else than science that helps me maybe in future to get other jobs, to have just a broader CV and not only being a scientist, because being a scientist is a hard job.
And did you have some kind of training before you started with this position, or did you start with some training during the, or was it just learning by doing?
It was learning by doing. I was not prepared at all, but I started with this position in April 2016, so 4 years from now. Such a long time now. But there, the project was not that big. It was thought to be big, but it was not that many people involved, and it was still the planning stage of the project. So I could really grow with the project. I could get in touch to people and get to know all the relevant people from Mosaic. And everything was kind of step by step, and that helped a lot. So I really grew up with the project.
So you grew while the project grew.
Exactly.
So to say. Okay. And what would you think now? I mean, now you're in that position, like about the fourth year?
4 years, yes.
4 years. So what would you think, what does a good project manager need in order to manage such a big project?
He need to be organized.
Organized, yeah.
Organized and structured and to have a good... skill to make their own schedule and
which we actually saw you are structured just from being the murderer.
The Excel sheet. I was about to say the exact same thing. Organized person.
I think that is the most important.
Does it happen that you forget something? Never.
Actually, I don't think so, because I have I have several to-do lists. So they are handwritten, always handwritten to-do lists, and there is a list that with all the to-dos that I want to do today, and then there's a list that needs to do within in a week or two, and then there's a long-term to-do list. So and then put stuff from one to the other list then.
That is amazing, honestly.
And I have another list with all the stuff that I need to know from Markus Rex, the coordinator. So he has his own list.
So you have a Markus to-do list.
Exactly. All things that I have to ask him.
And what would you say was the most difficult part for you taking on this job?
I was struggling a bit with the financial part, to say so, because I don't study economics or anything like this. So that was, and with this big budget that Mosaic has, I was really struggling. But then it became bigger and bigger. now in the finance department, there is a person responsible for all the Mosaic budgets. Yeah.
It makes sense.
Because I was, that makes sense. So otherwise it would not, I could not handle this. So.
Yeah, because you have to think of so many things and then also having to screw these numbers somehow.
And when it comes to like you being on board, were you like the project manager, or like did you have the chance to like, you know, change hats and like be the scientist a little bit more? Like how did it work?
I was working in the atmospheric field, and but of course the cruise leader Christian Hartz and the co-cruise leader Benjamin Rabe asked me to be part of the group leader team. So group leader is, so for each Mosaic scientific team, there's one responsible person on each leg that is a group leader. And they have special meetings and we present their scientists on board and so on. And they asked me, as Ben and Christian asked me, to be part of this team as well. Because I just have the best overview about the whole project. And
Of course, you are the knowledgeable person probably.
And I'm the closest contact to the coordination at home, so
true.
That totally makes sense. And, so I joined the meetings, I joined the discussions and give advices, and I help. What I've really found a lot of fun was I helped to make this cabins plan for the Polarstern and for the Kapitan Dranitzin, so that we have done this together, and that was a lot of fun.
So you decided who would go in which cabin together,
yes. I mean, I don't know if everybody was happy in the end, but we have done our best.
So apart from planning the cabins, how did you work on board to plan things?
So in the beginning, we had, I think, maybe once a week a group leaders meeting. But in the end, it's getting more often when all the situation was about the Kapitan Dranitzin arriving later to the ice flow, and about this exchange where maybe helicopters were involved, and to do, for example, that we have to do a priority list. If in case Kapitan Dranitzin will not make it to the flow, that we have then a list who should go first with the helicopter, because then we are not sure if everybody could be exchanged, actually. So that was the main task in at the end of the expedition. And other than this, we discussed, of course, the cruise report that need to be written afterwards, and the group leaders meeting, the group leaders just can talk about how their teams are doing, if they are able to manage the whole scientific program that they are supposed to do, so these kind of things.
Good. And then you also worked as an atmospheric scientist on board. So we can talk about this in a moment. You brought a really nice other song. 99 Luftballons, 99 Balloons.
This is one of the first German songs that I have ever listened, because we learned it at the German class.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I honestly was not familiar with German music at all before that. And this was my first contact with this. And I enjoyed it very much. I was happy to see it on the playlist.
Yeah. Because you chose the song because you were responsible for launching the weather balloons every morning. And it wasn't 99 balloons, but
close to.
It was 77.
Balloons. So you launched 77 balloons, and we're going to talk about this just after we listen to Nena, 99 Luftballons. We want to know a little bit more about Anja being on board, working on board, doing
atmospheric
77 radio sound launches.
Yes.
Yeah. I think I said before, I'm part of the atmosphere team. answer.
So you have first question, right? You have a jacket of the team atmosphere. Is that what I'm sort of guessing? Ah, she's showing it.
Oh, you have it there. Yeah.
I'm atmosphere.
Awesome. You are the first non-sea ice person that we have on this on this podcast.
You launched Radio Sons, actually, which is very good for us for the Year of Polar Prediction.
We love Radio Sons.
And also the balloons from Nena, yes. Of course, but mostly the weather balloons.
Yeah.
Anya, can you please confirm? So in a routine from Polarstern, there are 4 Radio Sons per day launched during the whole entire Mosaic experiment. Yeah,
exactly. And as far as I know, all were launched. So there's no missing weather balloon at all since we started.
It's a lot of data then, right?
It is. Yeah, it is a lot of data. Yeah.
And then I can say that Mario and Maturilli sent an email because we had the targeted observing period just until early this week with its warm air intrusion into the Arctic. So we got a schedule of Polarstern launches. And then there were, because of the targeted observing period run by Jop, and there were extra launches in addition to those 4 per day. So they did some also within a, you know, a three-hour interval, which is very good. We are really appreciating this effort you and your colleagues are doing on Polarstern.
I think we are getting a lot of help with the radio sounds because even people that are not involved in this program really like to launch them because it's not that difficult. Thanks a lot to all the helping hands. we have done 4 a day. And so I was doing always this one in the morning. And my colleague Egon was doing this one in the evening. And at noon, it was done by the German Weather Service people. And in the night, it was done by other colleagues. They are mostly from the Atmospheric Radiation Measurement System from the Department of Energy in the US. Yeah, they are launching doing the night shift there. Yeah, so, and I always did this in the morning. And my alarm goes always at 7:13 to just get dressed and brush my teeth. And then I go up in the office and start the preparation, and the whole thing took me 30 minutes, 35 minutes sometimes. Yeah.
Okay, and then we have to ask a question now because you're giving it us. Why 7:13? What is about this time
because,
in the morning?
Brushing teeth and getting dressed took me approximately 10 minutes. And then I just...
run.
And because we have this timing that we have
to... You could just put the alarm clock to 7:10 or 7:15,
no,
but 7:15.
So 7:15 could be too late to launch the balloon.
Okay.
Because there's this small window of 30 minutes where we are allowed to launch the balloon. And I want to always start it in the beginning of the time window. Because if anything went wrong, I have the time to prepare another one.
Yeah.
And launch it then the second then in the end of the 30 minutes time window. So that's why I always want to start it in the beginning. And when I get up at 7:10, then it's 3 minutes less sleep, and I would launch it too early. So
why not putting the alarm clock at 7:10 and lay in bed
3 minutes and then get up?
When the alarm goes, I have to get up. That's my usual procedure.
How long does it take to prepare a balloon exactly? Like, what do you have to prepare?
First, I start to prepare the sond. That are several steps but they are working. It's working almost automatically, and that took in total maybe 20 minutes sometimes, something 20 minutes. And we had the, because I was there in winter, and the winter, the stratosphere was very, very cold. That is normal. And then it happens as soon as I arrived on Polarstern, and as soon as I did my first balloons, we recognized that they don't go up to their usual height of 30 kilometers, but only around 20 kilometers. And that is because it's too cold in the stratosphere. And then we need to start to put the balloons in the bath of a mixture of oil and kerosene. And that softens the material a little bit so that it's getting more flexible and they don't explode that early. So then they start again up to almost 30 kilometers again. So that took some time as well to prepare the balloon. Yeah. And then we just fill it with gas, with helium, and fix the sonde on the balloon and then launch it from from the helicopter deck. Yes.
Cool. Okay. Can we go back one step? I think not every one of our listeners maybe know what a radio sonde balloon is.
Yeah, that's true.
So we might explain to them what is it. So it's a weather, so it's a balloon. This is bigger than just one Nena sings
one.
About.
Yes.
A normal one. Yes.
Yeah.
It's usually it's white.
Yes.
And and you put some thing you call the sonde. You put it on the balloon, on this line where the balloon is.
Yeah, exactly. So
the
sonde itself is the measuring device. So there you can measure temperature, humidity, and so that's standard meteorological data.
What is it? So that's something I want to know. So it's temperature. It measures temperature and it measures humidity.
Humidity and wind, and with you can get the pressure, the air pressure as well, and. This sonde is like this size, maybe 20 centimeters long, 15 centimeters long, maybe. And it's very light. It's only 90 grams or something. It's very, very light. So it just needs to be calibrated. And therefore, that's for what we do for the preparation. So the calibration and put it in a humidity chamber for simulating 100% humidity. And so that's all the calibration process that we do with a radio sonde.
What is a humidity chamber? How does it look like? Is that also a box with water, full of water?
No, it's not full of water, but it's kind of, I don't know, it's maybe this size, and it is around...
So now Anya shows a bit bigger, like, I don't know, between my chairs here, actually, I would say 30 centimeters, something.
International system, like between the two kissing chairs.
Yeah, and there is a tiny little layer of water inside. So it's like this height, and then you have water inside, but only a little bit. And then there is a ventilator, so that start circling. And you put the sonde in this chamber and leave it there for I think three minutes, and then it's. Simulating 100% of humidity in a room. So this chamber with the water in it and then the ventilation. And it is heated, of course. Yeah, of course, it's heated.
So it will be getting like really hot or
no,
what is...
No, I think around 28 degrees. It's just important that it is warmer than the surrounding temperature. And then I go with the prepared sonde, I go out and... The balloon is also already in the bath of, so the balloon is going in the bath of oil and kerosene. It is in the mixture is in a target box, and you just put the balloon, the empty balloon in it, and then you have to hang it up a little bit so that the droplets can fall down, and you fill the balloon with the helium, and. After this, there you put this unbinder on the balloon, and that is where you have this tether, where you put the sonde then on. So you have the balloon, the tether, and then the sonde.
How long does a weather balloon leave normally?
To go up to 30 kilometers, maybe one hour 15 minutes or something like this. So 80 minutes in total, okay. Maybe. Yeah.
What was the balloon that has had highest elevation, the one you launched? Do you remember? Of the 77 balloons.
I didn't check this actually, but it were more than 29 kilometers. But the highest balloon at all, doing like two, was launched by the German Weather Service people.
Okay. And how far did that go? Do you remember that number?
More than 30 mm-hmm. kilometers.
Okay. So you launched these radio sounds, but you also said you worked with other instruments, sometimes with ozone sounds. So you have to explain us, first of all, what an ozone sound is in relation to a radio sound, and then also what is Miss Piggy?
Okay, ozone sounds we launched once a week, and that are much bigger boxes with a sound. And on the ozone sound, you need to attach a radio sound as well for all the other data. So you still need the meteorological data and the position. And then you take a bigger balloon. So it's, again, a white balloon, but it's a bigger one, and you put much more helium in it so that it can carry the weight of the sound. And with this sound, we can just measure the ozone distribution in the troposphere and the stratosphere, and we do this once a week.
Just recently there was a lot things in the news about this thinning of the ozone layer across the Arctic, which was I think three times the size of Greenland. So did you, I mean, you probably also haven't looked at the ozone zone data yet, but was that somehow that you could, I don't know, observe this from Polarstern already? Or
I heard that the people from LexWi have had a look at the data and checked this, and they found this.
Yes, because this just happened now. It's right. You haven't been in the Arctic, yes. Okay, and now you have to tell us who is Miss Piggy.
Yes.
Yeah, Miss Piggy is our tethered balloon. So again, it is a balloon. And it is 9 cubic meters big, so really big. It's red, so it has a very nice color. And it's filled with helium as well. And it is, because it's a tethered balloon, so it is attached on a tether with a winch, and it can go up to 1,500 meters. And on the tether, you can put instruments. And with these instruments, you can go up and down in the planetary boundary layer. So you can use it until 1,500 meters, but I think the maximum that we reached were 900 or 1,000 meters. Yeah, and then you put instruments on the tether. And then the balloon goes
up. You measure something much closer to the surface with Miss Piggy, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So because they are the radio sounds and ozone sounds go up to 30 kilometers, and now we are just around 1 kilometer. Yeah. And Miss Piggy is stored in Balloon Town, and I think Balloon Town is the prettiest place on the whole ice floe, because it are.
I mean, also the name Balloon Town.
Yes.
It's great.
And I think you gave a picture also to us, so we can share this with our followers on Instagram. The Instagram account is at Polar Prediction. We will share this with you.
Perfect. Yeah, because there are two orange tents. And they are illuminated from inside, so we always have the lamps
cool.
on, and it looks so pretty. Yeah, from the ship, it's so pretty. Yeah, and we put different instruments on Miss Piggy and launched her as often as we can, because it's very sensitive to the wind conditions. So it's not working when we have more than 5 or 6 meters per second wind on the ground. And it happened very often that the winds were stronger, so we could not work with Miss Piggy. On the Tethys balloon, we put as well a sonde that is measuring all the meteorological data. And then we can put as well instruments from other institutes. So they wanted to use Miss Piggy as a platform for their instruments. And there we work together with the Tropos Institute in Leipzig and put their turbulence sensor on Miss Piggy. And with the British Antarctic Survey, they have an instrument that is an aerosol filter and collects aerosol particles. That is as well an instrument that we put there. And as well an ozone sonde, but this time it's organized from NOAA and University Boulder.
Mm. So basically you can attach more instruments to Miss Piggy than you can measure with the radio sonde or with the ozone sonde, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. We have, with Piggy can have, I think, 4 kilograms of a payload.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And it was always, preparing all the radio sonde, that was very easy task, and it was on board Polar Stern, but preparing with Piggy is really a tough job. So opening up the tents is that are really big tents, and they are very with a stiff material, mm-hmm. and it was really always an effort to open the tent to prepare Miss Piggy to because she always loses some helium and you have to refill a little bit and then to bring Miss Piggy out and everything. So that took us 45 minutes preparation every time.
How many people are working on one Miss Piggy flight? Are you two? Okay.
Yeah, we are two. We are two. And and the time extends when we have to shovel snow, for example.
No winter service on Mosaic.
Yeah. So, and that was that was a tough job. Yeah. So we when we work with Miss Piggy, we work with her for a whole day. So it don't make sense to prepare everything and use it only in the morning. So that no, that was not possible. Yeah. In the beginning, when the weather was nice for a couple of days, we had leave her out during night in parking position so that and start next morning immediately with putting on the sondes and then start with the measurements. Yeah, but in the end it was not possible. We were happy to have at least one day of measurements and then we have to bring back everything. So
and then just pack it.
Yeah,
it's really cute you're talking about Miss Piggy like as if she would be a lady. So I think she has a special role in your atmospheric observatory, hasn't she?
Yeah, she has, and everybody loves her. So we had so many visitors who are curious about Miss Piggy, who want to see her from in the tent, and then how we launch it. And a lot of people visit us.
I think we can have another music, and we have the Cornell Trio. Fahren Sie nicht zum Nordpol. Again, I didn't know this song before I was preparing the playlist, but as soon as I heard it, I let it. Oh yes, this is exactly what I need in like a moody day. This is great. Why did you choose this song?
Yeah, but I do wanted to go to the North Pole, so I really wanted, but I like the song a lot, and because it's in this oldest it's a very old song and it has this cool style, and I really like this. Yeah,
cool. Then let's hear it.
The Year of Polar Prediction is an initiative of the World Meteorological Organization.
It is a 10-year program with the goal to improve weather and sea ice forecast in the Arctic and Antarctic.
The Year of Polar Prediction brings together the international science community with the national weather centers and those people who are actually using weather and sea ice forecast in their daily work and life.
Mosaic is a huge international project coordinated by the German Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research.
For 1 year, from September 2019 to October 2020, Polarstern, the German research icebreaker, is frozen into the central Arctic sea ice. Around Polarstern, there is a distributed network of instruments set up of the surrounding sea ice flow.
These instruments on the ice provide a unique data set that never existed before In particular, measurements will be taken during polar night.
These extra observations will cover all aspects in the Arctic, from the atmosphere through the sea ice and into the deep ocean.
These observations will improve our understanding of the changing Arctic climate and weather.
Based on this better understanding, models that forecast weather and sea ice in the Arctic can be improved, which is crucial for the Year of Polar Prediction.
Therefore, MOSAIC has been endorsed by the Year of Polar Prediction, as it will significantly contribute to making better weather and sea ice predictions for the Arctic.
So we are back from our music interlude. That's the word that I was looking for when we were talking with Stefan, interlude. Yeah. And I think he was looking for the same one. It's just that then we just went for a break because, yeah, it's much easier. But yeah. So in this part, maybe we can maybe talk briefly about, well, what we are doing at the Year of Polar Prediction and maybe how the work in MOSAIC can contribute to this, because it's worth stressing this is the official podcast of the Year of Polar Prediction.
Yeah.
Always good to remind that. And of course, a MOSAIC and the Year of Polar Prediction kind of, you know, intertwine in many ways in the work that they are doing and the overall goal, at least for YOP, which is to enhance weather predictions in the polar regions.
Yes, I was participating in one of the special observing periods in New Ålesund. I think it was in autumn 2018, and I was there for a couple of weeks to launch the 4 daily weather balloons.
Anya did a very good job there, and we actually also put an Insta story on how to launch radio sound balloons, so
yes,
you can go
true.
Back to the Instagram yeah. account and check this.
And if you need a tutorial on how to do that, Anya is showing.
Yeah. But only about the radio sound, not about using Instagram.
Well, you know, if you can launch a radio sound balloon, you can for sure use Instagram, I would say.
For sure, yeah.
In terms of maybe like making weather prediction better from your atmospheric perspective, what is still not there maybe, or what would be the necessary step to make these prediction better? Do you think it's like, I don't know, lack of data, or should just be measure something else?
I mean, for example, there are studies that show that having additional radio sounds in the Arctic winter help to predict the weather in regions that are not in the Arctic. So, for example, in the mid-latitudes. Therefore, we are doing a good job there doing all these radio sound launches. But more generally speaking, the Arctic has a big impact on the weather and climate of the mid-latitudes and the rest of the world. But we don't have understood the Arctic processes and the Arctic climate very well. That is because we have a lack of data. And because nobody is in winter in the central Arctic and doing measurements. And therefore, we have to our parametrization in the weather forecasts or climate prediction models are not that efficient or kind of inefficient. And when we now with MOSAIC are in the Arctic, we do a lot of process studies and try to understand the processes that are going on there in the ice, in the ocean, in the atmosphere. So it's not only the atmosphere, it's with the coupled system that is important for the weather and climate prediction. Yeah, and we can now have the chance to understand all the processes and really to make the parametrizations better that then go into the weather and climate models, and then the forecasts and the predictions, long-term predictions, become better.
So Anya, when you did your PhD thesis, just reading the title of it, Quantification of Internal Variability in the Arctic Summer Atmosphere with HIRHAM 5 Ensemble Simulation. So that's really a modeling study, and we don't have to go deeper into that.
Yeah.
Probably we wouldn't understand about it.
Nope.
But by the time, did you experience also that there's a lack of observations from your modeling studies, or
my modeling study was not some kind, how to say, it was really theoretically, so I didn't look for for special, for events or for patterns or anything like this. It was really how the model was built, kind of, and I didn't recognize the lack of data because I didn't compare it with observations or anything like this. But I know there are lack of data and the models are not doing that good at the moment. So I know this, but for my thesis, it was not relevant.
And can you say in one sentence what your PhD thesis was about? I mean, variability in Arctic summer atmosphere. Is there something, you know, like a result you can put? I found, I don't know, the variability in the Arctic summer atmosphere is really high because something. Can you say something like that?
Variability in this sense is not about the climatic or atmospheric or meteorological variability. It's really the variability of the climate model itself.
Okay.
So I used ensemble simulations. So I had my ensemble was built with the Hoham 5, and I had 20 ensemble members. And ensemble members mean in this case that I changed the initial conditions of my simulations. So, and I did 20 simulations with the same model, but with a different initial conditions. And that leads that all the 20 simulations developed differently with time. And that the difference between, so the spread between all the model runs is, that's internal variability. A lot of studies deal with it, and a lot of studies investigate the quantity of the of their internal variability in the model, but nobody so far, apart from the Canadians that I worked together with doing my thesis, really found the reason, so the physical reason. I found out that it is not dependent of the model, but it is dependent on the region that you are looking for. Because I have done it for the Arctic and found that, for example, the synoptic event have a high impact on the variability.
Synoptic means what?
Weather pattern.
Okay.
And the Canadian group has done it for Northern America with their model, and they found that the radiative processes are more important.
And then sun radiation,
for example.
What?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And then the Canadian group has done the same with their model, simulated or has done the study over the Arctic. And they again found, like me, that the synoptic events and the baroclinic events are most important. So, and that we first thought it is a model thing, but it is really a location thing.
But I mean, interesting, yeah, because you need models to really understand the entire thing. And so, like Gunnar Spreen also said in the episode 4, the one before you, that I mean, you can have measurements and you can have the satellites looking at some point, but the models bring it really all together. Yeah. So it's important to understand what really is the trick, where you have to switch on or off, or
and what is to understand what is the model doing.
Yeah.
So
I had another question, and this is related again to the amount of data that is there that can help making prediction more accurate or better. Like, and now you were saying Mosaic is of course helping because they are making observation that would otherwise not be done because there is nobody in the Central Arctic. But we cannot do Mosaic every year. Otherwise, I think it would get crazy. No. So is 1 year of observation enough to make these adjustments? Or like, would you say we need to work and plan for something that is there also when Polarster is not?
I mean, it's never enough, and it would be perfect to have Mosaic I don't know for how many years, but it's not possible. But I think it is a great step into the right direction to really understand the processes. So that's why we have a 1 year expedition to see the transition between summer and start of summer to autumn and winter where this freezing then started, and then the whole winter, and then the melt season that we want to cover as well. So that are all processes, or that all processes are happening there that we don't have, that we didn't understand so far. And and that is a great step in the correct direction to just understand the processes that are happening in the Central Arctic. I don't know if or when something like Mosaic can be done again, because it's a huge effort we are planning now since 10 years, and even as well budget-wise, it's expensive. And yeah, we will see when it's coming next.
Yeah, I think in just in terms of atmospheric measurements, the Year of Polar Prediction actually plays a big or an important role here, because once we are done with the Year of Polar Prediction, that will be end of 2022, we will give recommendations to WMO, to the World Meteorological Organization, and they will be forwarded then to the nations who work in the polar regions, and will, you know, so that maybe they will increase observations at some stations, maybe during just these events, like we talked about, the warm air intrusions and cold air outbreaks, but maybe also on a regular basis, they will increase. I mean, that doesn't provide data from a central Arctic Ocean ice flow, of course, but it helps to at least increase some observational frequency.
And I know as well that there are some nations are thinking about having a ship permanently up in the Arctic. Other nations are thinking about a stable platform in the Arctic to perform measurements and so on. Of course, there are plans. But if they really can do this intensive measurements at once, how Mosaic has done it, I don't know. And if it's possible to have this coupled Arctic system, or if it's possible to investigate the coupled Arctic climate system with those platforms, because you need a lot of different expertise, and yeah, but that are great initiatives, and we should support those.
Well, I think we can move on to the next song, which is also an interesting one. You said, you wrote me before, because we also asked for some photos, because we usually share photos from our guests who have been at several legs of Mosaic on our podcast webpage. We can share this also in the descriptions of the podcast and on Instagram. And usually we put a gallery here, and then you send us pictures, but you said, unfortunately, you don't have so many pictures. What happened? Why? Are you maybe not, you're not just a picture taker, photographer so much?
I mean, when doing my first expedition in the Arctic, I took hundreds and thousands of pictures, but that was during daytime, so our polar day. And now I was there doing polar night, and it was really, really dark. And yeah, my camera skills are not that good. So I really was struggling with taking pictures that have a good quality. And because of the darkness, and a little bit maybe that I was not very patient out on the field to deal with my camera with minus 35 degrees.
I mean, it's hard to be patient.
But mainly it was because I really was not able to make pictures, good pictures of high quality in the darkness. And then we on Polar Stern, there's always this folder with pictures of the day, and there people can upload their photos of the day that they think are so great and should be shared. And I saw, oh wow, that are nice pictures. And then I just don't see the worth in the effort I do doing pictures on my own. I mean, it changed totally. As soon as the light comes back, then I took more pictures, especially on the way back with Capitan Tonitsin. I could have shared more of those, but they were not showing the fieldwork or the life in the Arctic and in the darkness
Totally agreed. I mean, when I try to make pictures at night in the darkness, it never shows up really nice. Yeah. So I'm also relying on other people's picture.
Yes.
But you brought this nice song, Farbfilm. This is the one sung by Nina Hagen, yeah?
Yeah, but I wanted to listen to the cover version by Radio Havana.
Yeah, so this was a song by Nina Hagen, famous German songwriter, but she was like a punk in the 80s, and she had the song, I think the title is only Farbfilm, which means the colored film, the colored thing you put into the camera, in the old-fashioned camera, to make photos. and she wrote that song about this couple, Michael, Micha, and her being on vacation. And she was really getting angry of him because he forgot this colored film. So, Anya, now we want to hear something about coming back to normal life, which wasn't any normal by then. So, first question would be, when did you hear about Corona on board the first time? How did you hear about it? And did you take it seriously, or what did you think by the time?
We on Polarstern, there's every day in German and an international small newspaper that is printed out, and that is organized by the shipping company of Polarstern, and they just put the latest news, and there we heard very early, actually, about the first cases in China. I think it was somewhere beginning or mid of January or something like this. Yeah, and we didn't took it serious at all. So, but then at some point we realized
that, like everybody else, just
exactly.
Didn't, you know, it was something far away.
Yeah, it is. And then at some point we recognized that the newspaper is dominated by those Corona entries, and we still were not taking it serious.
When was that? Do you remember what, I mean... When did you leave Polarstern? What date?
Beginning of March. On the, I think, 6th of March or 5th of March, I was able to read the last newspaper on Polarstern. Maybe it was sometimes in February, but we still were not taking it serious. But we heard from home via emails or WhatsApp from friends and family. We heard that the world is getting crazy, that people are panic buying. Is it the correct translation? And we kind of, we laughed about this. And
panic buying noodles and toilet paper in
toilet
Germany.
Paper, exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah, we just heard about this, and people from at home writing us, and I remember that a friend of mine, she plans to go to Italy in beginning of March, and she was asking me if she should go there or not, and I was like, well, it's not that dangerous, I think, just go there.
So via WhatsApp, she was, you were sending her messages via WhatsApp about...
And emails, yeah. We got use email and WhatsApp on Polarstern. And
it's nice that you also talked about other things other than being on Polarstern, that she is asking you, you know, even though you're in the middle of the Arctic, she's asking you about what should I do now.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. When we went on Dranitzin, we had in the beginning, I think we don't had a newspaper, but then finally we were able to get the Ostseezeitung and Nordseezeitung in digital versions. And there it was again, all the full with Corona. So that came time by time when we were on Dranitzin, and we were a little bit concerned about how we should go home. When no airport is open, and but Avi solved this and brought us home safely with a charter flight that was bringing us from Tromsø to Bremen, And so that worked out.
But you didn't have to be on a like a quarantine for a while or something. No, you mm-hmm. could just go. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, there wasn't any danger anyway on Tranitzin.
No, we mm-hmm. I mean, it was discussed. So that, for example, it could be when we enter Tromsø that we have to stay in quarantine on Tranitzin for 2 weeks. So that was something somebody mentioned, but it was then not true. It was not happening. And then we always argued that we are on quarantine since 4 months.
Exactly. Yeah, you were. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. But there were a lot of rumors. And what we don't took serious at all is that we are not supposed to travel and to visit family and friends. So we heard about this. We heard, okay, you are allowed only to meet one other person. You are allowed only to go out with your people you live with. But we heard of this, but nobody thought that people really act like this. And I still was thinking, okay, I go home to my family for Easter. And still until now, I didn't saw my family. And because then I recognized, okay, things are serious, people taking it serious. Police making controls, and so still here.
Yeah, and you haven't, as you said, you haven't seen your family since you left for the Arctic end of last year. So this is a really long time,
and it is sad. Especially I missed Christmas, I missed New Year's Eve, and now I missed all the birthdays of my whole family that have all in the beginning of the year, and now I miss Easter.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. But we will see how things change.
But how did you adapt now? I mean, okay, so you came back and you, of course, also washed your hands, and maybe you even have a...
Yeah.
Mask now or something. So I mean, you know, because coming back from a cruise like that is crazy on its own, you know, because you have to all the, like you wrote it in an email, all the other the impressions, you know, things like that. This is really difficult, but then the new normal, so to say, is so different from what you ever experienced before.
The thing is that the first thing I have done when I was back home the next day, I brought a bicycle because they stole my bike 3 days before I left.
No!
And, yes. And, my partner told me that you should not use public transports and you are not allowed to go anywhere. So, and the only thing you could go out is do some exercises like walking, running, or riding a bike, and then we just immediately go buying a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, I was so overwhelmed with this, all these impressions, but still the streets were kind of empty, but still I was overwhelmed. I could not manage, so my eyes could not focus on anything, and in the evening I had really a headache.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And then in Berlin, the parts where people live, they are not that empty as I expected, because the measures were already valid for 2 weeks and people just start going out again. And but where you really see the difference is on the touristic sightseeing places, like the Brandenburger Gate and the TV Tower. They are... There's nothing. There's not. Nobody is there. It's so empty. Yeah. But I live in Berlin Moabit, and that's almost as crowded as usual.
But as a project manager, how much are you hating the situation with regard to Mosaic and the project itself?
Yeah, for the project, I hate it a lot. I mean, for me personal, it's not that that difficult because my work is mostly checking emails, writing reports and all this that I can do from home as well. It doesn't matter if I'm in home or in office. But for Mosaic, it's a really terrible situation. So the cause that the aircraft campaign needs to be quit, it as well goes in line that the the exchange could not happen between leg two and between leg three and leg four, because aircrafts from Svalbard should be used for this, but Svalbard is still closed, so we could not do this. And so I really, for Mosaic, it's not a good situation, not at all. It makes things a lot more complicated. We have to adapt to so many situations, and yeah, it's a lot of work. So that's why I started only, I had 2 days off and then I started working again. So because the situation just needs all power.
And so, I mean, do you know about the atmosphere at the moment now? Are people just, I don't know, are they accepting what happened or are they really not happy about it?
Oh, it depends. I think there are a lot of people that really think, okay, I'm safe here and I like the work I do here, so I can stay longer and it doesn't bother me. But others with family, especially those with kids, they really want to go home. And in this difficult situation, people want to be with their families. Despite they are safe on board Polarstern and they cannot do anything for their family at home, they want to be with their family. Yeah. But others are doing great. It really depends on the person itself and what the personal situation is at home.
Yeah, because you said also you liked being a bit longer on Polarstern than expected, right? Yeah.
That was nice. Yeah, because I could see the sun in the twilight, not the sun, the twilight. I could see the twilight.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you're probably also in these kind of situations, you develop, even though there is probably a team, there should be a team spirit on board already with a normal situation. But now in these kind of situations, maybe there's even, I don't know, a stronger team feeling or something, I could imagine.
Yeah, I cannot speak for leg three, but for leg two, it was totally fine. So there was, that was nice. And then everybody continued working. It was a little bit, there were a couple of days with unsecure, because the situation was so unsecure, when Captain Dronitsin will arrive or if it will arrive at all. And that was a little bit strange because we don't know what to do, really, because we were supposed to stop work, I don't know, was it 8th of February, and to clean the labs, clean the offices and all this, prepare the handover and so on and so on. And we have done so, but then we learned the ship will be later and later and later. And then, okay, can we start working again? Work scientifically, do measurements and so on, and then we started again. But these couple of days were a little bit strange because nobody knows what to do, how to act, and but other than this, we were fine.
Yeah,
it's good to hear.
Yeah.
So I think, Sarah, we have another song here.
We have another song which is particularly well-fitting, I think, in terms of what we just discussed. And like, I was surprised to see that it existed, actually. And it's, and we mentioned that before, and it's called Nudeln und Klopapier.
Yeah.
So pasta and toilet paper, which have been just attacked at the supermarkets, at least in Germany. It's still hard to find. And somebody thought of putting them as a title of a song, which is by the Danger Dan, Nudeln und Klopapier.
We're actually moving towards the end of the podcast, but we have some more we still have some important question to ask Anya.
Go ahead.
So the first one would be, as always, from the previous guest. And so last time Gunnar came up with a cool one. He wanted to know what was the most surprising or like unexpected thing that you experienced in Mosaic, because he was talking about like shifting of the ice flow just so unexpectedly and like talking with a person that was just swapping by. What was for you?
We don't have those experience. Actually, our ice flow was very, very stable. We were surprised about this, that it was that stable.
That's an interesting point. Sorry to interrupt you. So during like two the ice flow was rather stable, because now it's again moving a lot. It's going into the south and to the salty Atlantic water. So probably that was the lake with the most stable ice flow then, right?
Probably, yes. Yeah, that was kind of surprising. But what I, for me personally, found surprising is how long it took to get dressed every time when you are going out. It took more than 20 minutes, I think, to really get on all your clothes, to prepare the hand warmer, to prepare the feet warmer and everything. It took 20 minutes or longer, and that I found surprising. So I really, when we had an appointment to meet at 1:30 in the gangway, I always had to start at around 1 to prepare and get dressed. But in the end, I was much faster, so then I know what to wear and what doing what temperatures, and then I really got faster. And what I as well, concerning temperatures, found surprising is how fast I adapted, and my body adapted to the cold temperatures. So it only a couple of days and I was not freezing on the body at all, only fingers and feet, of course. But yeah, I was prepared for this as well. And at some point when we had these storms, minus 20 degree feel warm and minus 11 degree were kind of hot. So that was very surprising by then. And now even coming back home, yeah, others wear a shirt and jackets and I just wear t-shirts. So that was, I found this really, really surprising for myself, because I was afraid about getting cold and how will I manage to be outside the whole day, but that was totally fine. So the Avi gave us proper clothes and my body really adapts very, very soon, very fast.
Good, but you managed to survive in the cold.
Yeah.
We also have some Instagram questions.
Okay.
We collected some over the last 24 hours. And we have some that we wanted to ask you. So one from Nastya, which is also happened to be our intern now for the next couple of months. And it's a more general question, but she wanted to know, what would you say now to your 20-year-old self?
Be more self-confident, maybe. Because when I was a young person, teenager, I was not that self-confident, and that hampered me often in some situations. But that changed during studying meteorology and making my PhD. And yeah, so that would be an advice.
Could you say, Anya, how did it happen that it changed? I mean, what do you need to get more self-confidence, so to say, from your perspective?
I think it was just that I recognized what I can achieve with a lot of work. Like going to a study like meteorology, it's not that easy. And it was especially not that easy for me with all the physics part and the mathematics part. But I managed with a lot of work and a lot of effort. And then getting this great PhD position at the Alfred Wegener Institute, that was really what I could achieve doing on my own and not being in a competition with others.
Another question, this is from Polar Thomas. This requires maybe a little bit of context. So for this Instagram Q&A moment that we have, well, more Q than A, but now we are answering. We put a great picture from Anya with a palm tree in the middle of the Arctic, which is actually an inflatable rubber palm tree, not an actual one. And so Polar Thomas wanted to know, where did you get the palm tree and if you still have it?
So this picture was made from my first expedition in spring to summer 2017. And there I was on Polarstern together with the sea ice group, Marcel Nikolaus and Christian Katlein from the IPB Institute. And they brought this palm tree. And it was a very famous spot on the ice floe. It was kind of mini mosaic because we had as well, we used Polarstern and docked with the ship on an ice floe and put a small ice camp and stayed there for several weeks and did measurements. So to test, that's why we call it mini mosaic. And there at the one site, this ROV site, which is this underwater roboter that
remotely operated vehicle, yeah. I think it's called, exactly. No? And it's going under the ice, measuring stuff in the ocean under the ice.
So especially how much light is going through the snow and the ice into the ocean. So mm-hmm. that is, for example, one thing that they like to measure. And I was working with them there, and they had this palm tree. And of course, we needed to make pictures with the palm tree. And I think they brought this palm tree to Mosaic as well. But I think it didn't survive long.
So it's broken now?
I don't know exactly. I think they tried on leg one to bring it out, but now it's not there any longer.
And last, Miss Catchy Pants wanted to know, what did a typical day look like for you on Mosaic on the expedition?
It depends if we are going outside or not, but when we are going out, then I get up at 7:13, make the radio sound until 8, then go for breakfast. Then there was a meeting at 8:30 to confirm if people can go out or not, or if there are any changes with the plan or whatever. And then Egon and I meet around 9:30 at the gangway and prepare the Miss Piggy tents and start measuring, going back for lunch on the ship. Have one round of ping pong every day.
Ping pong?
From 12:30 until 1. We played ping pong together with a couple of others that are mostly from the crew. And,
So instead of a nap, you did the ping pong?
Yes. And we did play this Chinese style, so running around the table.
Oh, cool.
And in the end, you could win a medal, and you have to bring it back next day, and then somebody else could win it, or you again. And that was a lot of fun. And then we meet again at 1:30 at the gangway for going outside, working with Miss Piggy, and coming back latest at, I think it was 5:30. Then we had dinner at 5:30, and then meeting at 6:30, and then it depends. Evenings, sometimes going in the sauna, going in the gym, or just going in the bar, or watching an episode, or going to the shops. Of course, you can go to the shops, buy souvenirs or drinks or sweets or salty stuff, whatever you like. Yeah.
So maybe now would be the time for you to ask the question to our next guest, which, again, we don't know who's going to be.
I thought about this a lot, and I found, because for me it was a little bit unexpected, but how changed your sleep schedule or your sleeping hours on Polarstern compared to your usual life? Because when I was in summer in the Arctic, I slept only 6 hours with daylight all time. It was totally fine. I was not tired. I was fit. I was everything worked out well with only 6 hours of sleep. But and at home, I usually have 8 hours that are fine for me. But now in the dark, I needed a little bit more sleep. So and that means getting up almost 7:15. I need to get to bed kind of early, so latest at 11. Yeah, that was really latest. And I want to know if other people have the same experience. But that, of course, depends on if you are next guest is somebody from leg 2 or somebody from leg 3.
Yeah, but an interesting question, because also, I mean, during the polar day, it's maybe difficult finding some sleep or something.
Yeah, and it's something that I would have not come up with, probably, because I, yeah,
I would have no idea. Yeah.
Because you don't set maybe your alarm clock at 7:13, Sarah. That's the thing.
I set my alarm clock at 7:30, and if I manage to get up at 8:20, I am super proud. So I am that kind of person.
On the ship, that would mean you don't get breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can get always, if you go in Messe 2, you can get always.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's different from having breakfast with your colleagues. Yeah. And
yeah, it's a social moment, of course.
Yeah, and it's also, again, shaping your network for getting cake in the afternoon.
Exactly, yeah.
Ah, well, it's Friday afternoon. I'm thinking of cake now. But we're really grateful, Anya, for having talked to you. And I think there are so many things we could go on forever, I feel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
Maybe there is time at another point to, I don't know, continue talking about things when we meet in person again.
Yeah, thank you for having me here. It was pleasure.
Yeah, I think it was really fun, even though we had some challenges here with blanket constructions, new microphones in the middle of the recording.
Yeah.
It was definitely different than the normal settings, which was very exciting.
Good job, lady.
Thank you very much again.
And have a good weekend now. Stay healthy. Thank you.
Bye.
The iSpot is produced by the Year of Polar Prediction International Coordination Office
with the technical support of Radio Weser TV,
as well as the support by the communication team of Mosaic and the Alfred Wegener Institute.
Editorial responsibility is with
Kirstin Werner and
Sara Pasqualetto.
Our theme music is composed by Kevin MacLeod, available on incompetech.com.
For any questions, please contact us at polarprediction@gmail.com.
Isn't that a good, nice Christmas present just after Easter?
That's awesome.